This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagering, and the show is Fight the Empire. And our guest is author and journalist Pepe Escobar, and we're trying to contact him as I speak. And so I hope our telephone magic works. His latest, he's written several books. His latest one is Globalistan, How the Globalized World is Dissolving into Liquid War. That was published by Nimble Books. He also writes regularly for Asia Times, which is an online journal. And I highly recommend Asia Times. It's got really interesting articles, and it's all free. And one recent article, which people might want to check out, is by a fellow named Kaveh Afrasiabi, and he's an Iranian-American. I think he teaches back east someplace, and he raised some interesting questions about this bus bombing in Bulgaria, which had been recently blamed on Hezbollah. Well, there are some questions about that, and Kaveh Afrasiabi raises them, so these are something to think about as we proceed. Things are not always what they seem. But you can find that in the Asia Times. That article was written on February 7th, which is today. Anyway, I hope we have Pepe Escobar soon. He's written a couple articles that I'd like to talk about, dealing with the recent fighting in Mali. And it's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. I think everybody realizes now that our supposed victory in Libya, getting rid of Colonel Gaddafi, had some really serious repercussions. There were people in Libya who were from African countries to the south, like Mali and Niger and other places, and I guess some were fought for Colonel Gaddafi. Others were just working in Libya. You know, I mean, Gaddafi had a lot of relationships with the rest of Africa. He wasn't just a Middle East leader, ruler, dictator, whatever you want to call him. And so when Gaddafi was overthrown, these people fled south with him back to their homelands. And the ones in Mali, they sort of instigate, or they sort of rebelled against the government of Mali. Also, there were among the people who overthrew Gaddafi were some what we call jihadi Islamic hardliners, sort of related to Al Qaeda, and they helped themselves to some really high-class weapons, and they vanished to cause trouble elsewhere in the region. And so what happened in Mali was that if you look at a map of Mali, this is really strange, is that you look at a map, it's an odd-shaped country. It's like there are two big areas that are sort of connected by a narrow isthmus or something, and there's the southern Mali is along the is mainly Black African, and northern Mali is up there in the Sahara Desert and the Sahel region, and the natives of that region are known as Tuaregs, and they were dominated by the rulers to the south. The Tuaregs are kind of a nomadic people in some ways, and they were ruled over by the southern Malians. And so when they returned from Libya, they kind of, it's a very sparsely settled area, and they sort of set up their independent region. But very interesting is they, that didn't last very long, because they in turn were overthrown by these Islamic militants. Now, the Tuaregs are Islamic people too, as far as I know, but they are not the, you know, the hardcore militant jihadis, whatever you want to call them. So they briefly ruled, but then they were overthrown. Meanwhile, the democratically elected government in the southern part of Mali was overthrown. It's ruled that that had happened a few months previous, and the country is now being run by a military ruler who, guess what, was trained at Fort Benning, Georgia. So there we have it. So then the French came in, and they drove out the Islamic militants, and which pleased the people who were living there, because these militants were not very nice people, very punitive, very harsh. And so the French are sort of in control, although I understand the war is going on elsewhere. It's sort of the Islamic militants left the main cities, which the French took over with ease. And so they went off into the desert, and I just saw something in the news today that they are fighting back. So could be very much like Iraq, when the U.S. Army, invaded Baghdad very easily. But then that was just the beginning of a very, very long war. So anyway, the Islamic people are the jihadis are fighting back. And I'm not sure exactly what's happened to the Tuaregs. They were just interested in sort of self-rule. And from what I've been hearing is that they have been punished by the southern Malians and executed and whatever. And so it's a very nasty situation. It's the French might have gotten into more than they can deal with. Although right now they are hoping to get out, and the big drive now from is to create some kind of an African peacekeeping force or whatever. Well, the Malian army did not do very well against these rebels. They're doing somewhat better now with French support. There are moves to have the Organization of African Unity step in and send their troops there, but that hasn't happened yet, and I don't know how soon it will happen. I think they're talking about several months at least. So there we have it. One of the things that Pepe Escobar in one of his articles says, and I wanted to ask her about this. We're having trouble getting through to him, so I don't know if we can't get through to him. I will. Do we have him on the line? We're trying. Anyway, one thing I want to ask him about is he talks in his one article about the war in Mali. He talks about timing is everything, and he mentions a carefully choreographed Libyan blowback in the Sahel. So this is something I would like to ask him about, because apparently, according to some people, this blowback where the people fleeing Libya getting involved in wars elsewhere in northern Africa, it may not have been that. Well, the implication is that this was sort of planned that way. It wasn't just a kind of a horrible blowback incident. And it's that's one thing I want to ask Pepe Escobar about, because I read another article, and this is by a professor, Jeremy Keenan. And he writes in the New Internationalist magazine, and he says that these Islamic militants, the one who took over that gas installation and held hostages and tried to blow the whole thing up. And oh, dear, I guess we can't get Pepe Escobar today. That is too bad. But anyway, well, we will just proceed. I will tell you what this article has said. And if you want to call in with questions, I can try and answer them. The number here is 503-231-8187. So anyway, according to Jeremy Keenan, who is a professor in the UK, he says that these militants, the ones who took over this gas installation in Algeria, were actually run by Algerian intelligence. Now, this is very interesting. This is something I had not seen before, but Keenan, in his article, gives lots of specifics about it. And so it's an article. It's worth checking out. It's the New Internationalist magazine. And his name is Jeremy Keenan, K-E-E-N-A-N. So there's apparently more going on here than we've been led to believe. Also, according to Pepe Escobar, all of these various factions and people fighting are financed by the Emirate of Qatar. And it's he raises some very interesting questions about that. What is Qatar up to? Well, this is Fight the Empire, and my name is Per Fagrang. We're hoping to have author and journalist Pepe Escobar as our guest, but we had a little glitch, and so maybe we get him some other time. But I will tell you as best I can what he said in his two articles that I'm talking about, that these are on the Asia Times. So go to Asia Times online. You can find them. Asia Times, they're really a very, very interesting website. His other article talks about, the title is All That Pivots is Gold. And what he says is that China, right now, China is trying to buy up gold like crazy. It's kind of a gold rush going on. That China is the world's top gold producer, which is news to me, and the world's top gold importer. So they're really going for gold. They don't have a huge amount as a percentage of their economy. Other countries like the U.S. and Great Britain have more, but China is really trying to amass a lot of gold. Okay, we have a call. Thomas on the line. Hello, Thomas.
Yeah, good morning, Per. Love your program, and sorry you couldn't get Mr. Escobar on this morning. Just a few thoughts about Africa in general. You mm-hmm. know, it's really harrowing. All the ingredients of a long-term strife and superpower proxy wars are just continue to build in Africa. I mean, you know, you're alluding to some of the issues with the gold and resource extraction, which really is the name of the game behind much of this. But not only that, but, you know, we have a situation where China has bought up huge blocks of arable agricultural land. This mm-hmm. has been going on for a number of years and accelerating. And now there's actually a stock market-based speculation boom. You have private equity funds and all these other entities buying up lock, stock, and barrel farmland.
That's true, yes. A lot of the Middle Eastern oil countries are doing that because they don't have any farmland themselves. And China, of course, I believe South Korea is another. And I believe, Europeans and America, there's a big land grab in Africa.
Yeah, it's really something. It's a whole new phase of sort of a neo-imperialist phase that's going on. You know, I wondered about this several years ago, back in the 90s, during the Clinton administration. I remember there was a big presidential junket to Africa where several heads of states were met with, and there was much to do about military cooperation. And the first thing I thought was, well, here we go. you know, Latin America is getting to be much more unified against regressive neoliberal policies and Hugo Chavez and also the, you know, the leader in Ecuador getting to form a bulwark. And then also in Asia, you have the situation where China is becoming its own player in its own region.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you look at the entire globe and you think about what region is there that Western powers can really sort of dip their hand back into the cookie jar and engage in these proxy wars for resources. And, well, naturally, of course, you know, enter the Obama era, and we have AFRICOM.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, nothing is really what it seems. And I fear that between, you know, we're going to be, unless we really can step in somehow and put the kibosh on things like this AFRICOM plan of arming to the teeth all of these African nations and creating bases, we're going to have essentially resource and mineral proxy wars, bloody, horrible proxy wars into the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
I hope I'm wrong, but I don't know how else really to translate what's going on right now.
Well, let me address that a little bit. I think, you know, it's one thing to supposedly buy up or lease this land. It's another thing to actually hold on to it and bring back crops, food from that land. So that is, if things really fall apart and there are wars going on around Africa, these other countries may have a hard time at bringing back these crops that they think they own. An interesting thing about the gold is that the reason, now this is what Pepe Escobar writes, and I've seen this, other people are saying this, there's some financial kind of observers that I subscribe to, and that some of them are saying the same thing, that China is trying to amass a lot of gold, and with the objective, when they get enough gold, then they can float their own currency, the yuan or the renminbi, as a international reserve currency. But they need to have more gold behind them to do that. You know, the U.S. used to be backed by gold, but Nixon ended that in 71, I believe. So that seems to be China's, at least according to Pepe Escobar and other financial observers, China is trying to, is preparing to dump the dollar.
Yeah, and it's interesting. And, of course, that dovetails with what we know about over the last couple of years of Russia, China, a lot of the Middle Eastern countries actually having meetings discussing the de-dollarization of oil exchanges. And then also I've been hearing the last few months that central banks that are having their, of various countries that are having their gold held in places such as the United States and Fort Knox, are repatriating their gold. They're asking those banks to repatriate. So
I was going to bring that up. Apparently, Germany has requested its gold to be returned, and now the Federal Reserve says it needs 7 years to get all that gold together and return it to Germany. And that just seems amazing to me. I wonder, do we have that gold, or have we done something else with it? I remember Mike Rupert was saying before that in the world economy, there is five times as much so-called paper gold as there is real gold. In other words, you can think you're investing in gold. You buy some certificate from somebody saying, yes, you own so many ounces or pounds of gold, and we have it stored for you. but they don't.
Lo and behold, it doesn't exist. You know, that mm-hmm. I think that's very prescient. And indeed, you think about any sort of commodity or pseudo commodity like real estate or any of these things. I mean, we think to the recent real estate bubble where we had all of this massive paper investment in these mortgages, and there's even some credible talk that many of these properties had multiple mortgages, were assessed multiple times.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's like all Ponzi schemes or bubbles, as long as nobody calls it out, these notional valuations can continue. But what's going to happen? What would happen to the international monetary system if all of a sudden it was revealed to any great degree that this gold didn't exist? And I think this dovetails, and one can see why all of this this gold mining is continuing with fevered pace. With the Canadian gold mining companies in particular are some of the strongest players in that,
mm-hmm.
going all over to get that gold. And as far as the situation you talked about with the arable lands being purchased, or leased, as it were, well, what's going to happen? I mean, particularly going forward with looking at the volatility of weather systems and rainfall patterns, what's going to happen in some of these countries when people find out, when there's a time of famine, and they find out that a huge percentage of their this cropland is exporting food to places like China and Europe?
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is just a complete recipe for warfare and strife in that area, and I don't see any way around it. What's going to be next? Are we going to have a NAFTA-like program for Africa? I can smell it just around the corner.
It could be,
Yeah, so anyway, thanks for taking my call, Pierre. Okay. I love your program.
Well, keep thanks. You raised some good questions. So apparently China is trying to get together enough gold to float its own reserve currency. We might talk a little bit here about what is a reserve currency. Well, right now, the U.S. Years ago made a deal with Saudi Arabia, with a Saudi ruling family, that we would protect them from all enemies, and they in turn would sell us not only sell us oil, but they would they would not sell anybody oil anywhere in the world unless that other country paid in dollars. So that means other countries have to hang on to their dollars and accumulate them so that they can buy Saudi oil. So here are all these other countries in the world, and they have their little stash of dollars, and they use it to buy oil from Saudi Arabia. And then, of course, Arabia turns around and invests those dollars in the U.S. in treasury bills or stock market or whatever. And the other countries, I mean, they sort of have to, dollars become pretty valuable for lots of reasons, even though it's what they call a fiat currency, kind of created out of nothing. So that means that these dollars have to be, people need to hold on to them and use them. And so we're in a situation where the U.S., because of that, because its dollar is privileged in the world economy, the U.S. can borrow very, very cheaply. These countries buy T-bills for very low rate of interest. So the U.S. is able to borrow so much money and accumulate so much debt because it's cheap. Well, if for some reason the dollar is no longer the reserve currency of the world, other countries would not need to hang on to it, and they can do what they want with it. They can sort of slowly get rid of it, which apparently is what China has been doing. China's been slowly kind of getting rid of its dollars, using them to buy up resources and other things. Well, and this is something I am still trying to figure out. I hear that if the dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency, and we are no longer able to borrow money cheaply, and if the interest rates rise enough, the dollar is in real trouble. The effect would be that the interest rates in this country go sky high. Right now, they're pretty low, but they can skyrocket. It means that no longer do we import anything from the rest of the world because it's just too expensive for our suddenly feeble dollar. Well, try and think that through. I've been trying to, and it's just it's really kind of amazing. How would your life be changed if all of a sudden nothing imported is available in the stores? Think of all the things we import, and they're not there anymore. Think of if you want to borrow money, if you're, credit card or anything else, student debt or a mortgage, if the interest rates go up 2, 3, or 4 times, would you even be able to consider borrowing this money? What would your life be like? So this is one thing I've been trying to puzzle out. And so anyway, if China is able to dump the dollar, now a sidelight to this is that other countries have their own agreements that they trade among themselves in different currencies. They no longer use a dollar for every transaction. Say if China and Brazil have some deal going, they don't have to denominate it in dollars. They just denominated in their own currencies. And the same thing is happening with other countries. Now, they say that one reason we overthrew Saddam Hussein was because he wanted to sell Iraqi oil for other currencies besides the dollar. And they say that Colonel Gaddafi was doing the same thing. He was sort of floating a gold-backed African dinar or something or other. And the government of Iran has been working on setting up an oil market that deals in different currencies. Of course, they have, you know, with the embargo that we imposed on Iran, they are still selling their oil. Apparently, Iran and India are trading in oil in gold. So this is a development that's very interesting. Guess what? Mali does have a lot of gold. And so, who gets that gold? Will China somehow make a deal for that gold? Or will the French be able to get it? Neighboring Niger has uranium. Apparently that is where France gets its uranium supply, because France is heavily dependent on nuclear power, and they get their uranium from Niger. If you remember back when the Iraq War was going on, there was this sort of phony thing about Saddam Hussein supposedly buying up uranium from Niger, which is all a hoax, but that's where that uranium supposedly came from. So what's going on in Africa has bigger connections than just a war against the Islamic militants. It's a situation we will keep our eye on, and I wish we had Pepe Escobar. We will try and get him back again in the future. But that, in sum, is what he said in these two articles, and I highly recommend going online. Go to Asia Times, and you can read them for yourself, along with lots of other interesting stuff. So stay tuned for KBOO, your radio station.
Hope you're enjoying the programming this morning on your community radio, KBOO Portland. We're about an hour away from Between the Covers. Today at 11, host Don Merrill interviews local novelist and former county commissioner Carolyn Miller about her work, publishing, and the writing process. At 11:30, it's Black Book Talk, information and interviews about books by Black authors. Thanks, KBOO members, for your ongoing support for community radio. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today. Coming up next on KBOO, it's Flashpoints.
KBOO Radio is proud to help sponsor Threshold, Black Water Snake, a benefit for the Oregon Acupuncture and Naturopathic Associations. Saturday, February 9th, from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m., will be a Chinese New Year party. And Sunday, February 10th, from 6 to 10 p.m., will be a benefit auction fundraiser. Both events will be held at Refuge PDX, 116 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. The Blackwater Snake is intuitive, a socially adventurous spirit that loves taking risks. The theme encourages discovery of balance in the feminine and masculine energies within ourselves, our relationships, our communities, and the world at large. More information can be found at kboo.fm/threshold2013.
This is Rachel and Justin from Music from the True Vine inviting you to Once in a Boo Moon, an evening of live music provided by KBOO DJs.
We'll be joined by our fellow Music from the True Vine hosts as the True Vine Ramblers, performing a set of traditional bluegrass. Our special guests will be Deanne Nelson and Jim Seafield.
Other acts include Henry and Moggy doing some down-home ragtime and country, Don McLaren and his fiddlin' friends putting the bow to some old-time fiddle tunes, and Retta Christie and her one-night stand band performing Western Swing.
Once in a Boo Moon is on Saturday, February 23rd at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church from 7 to 10 p.m.
Doors open at 6 o'clock p.m. Plan on arriving early, as ticket prices also include desserts with coffee or tea.
For event and ticket price details, go to kboo.fm/BooMoon2013.
Once in a Boo Moon is a benefit for your community radio station, KBOO.
Flashpoints, we report on a national day of actions by educators against standardized testing. Also, postal workers and their supporters fight back against major cuts in the postal system. And the ghost of Judy Berry still biting at the heels of the FBI and the Oakland Police Department. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Well, first up, attacks on the post office. We are going to take a look at what Congress is trying to do to privatize one of the key institutions that working people still depend on. And joining us to talk about this is Jamie Partridge. He's founding member of Communities and Postal Workers United. He joins us from Portland, Oregon. Also, we're joined by our own Dave Welsh. He's here in the Bay Area organizing in support of the post office. And in a moment, I think we'll be joined by Gray Brecken. Let me begin with you, Jamie Partridge, founding member of Communities Postal Workers United. What's at stake here? What's this big battle about?
This big battle is about union busting and privatization of the Postal Service. Postal Service is a $67 billion business, profitable. The 1% would love to get its hands on the Postal Service. And as we know, as the attacks on public services generally and public service workers and our unions